Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. The documentary Manzanar Diverted, When Water Becomes Dust, chronicles a dark chapter of California history. The film documents the history of Native Americans who were brutally forced out of their ancestral lands in what is now called Owens Valley, which is 230 miles northeast of Los Angeles. Their forced removal made way for white settlers and 11,070 Japanese Americans who were incarcerated at the Valley's Manzanar camp from March 1942 to November 1945. The Los Angeles Department of Water and Power bought out much of the Valley to supply fresh water to the growing population in Los Angeles. In the film, we meet intergenerational women from Native American, Japanese American, and rancher communities who form an unexpected alliance to defend their land and water from the LA Department of Water and Power. Here is the film's trailer.
There's stories about things that happen here, but nobody listens. My people, my ancestors, my grandparents have lived on this lake for thousands of years. Outsiders came into this valley and renamed it. We call it Paiahunahtu, which means the place where the water always flows.
I was evacuated from Los Angeles on May 9, 1942. We were sent to the Manzanar concentration camp. The period I spent in Manzanar was the most traumatic experience of my life.
Manzanar is 1 square mile of land that has a deep history of forced removal.
Los Angeles, bones of the heart of the valley.
They came here for the water.
They are trying to recharacterize this valley as always being a desert. What made it such a desert is their pumping.
This was the lake. This was all water before that.
Many people who lived at Manzanar developed upper respiratory breathing problems, like my grandmother.
I just don't have any energy. When I walk a little ways, I get tired real fast.
Not only was water a major factor in the siting of Manzanar, water was also the means of resistance.
This water, our water, it's there for everybody. Natives, non-natives, everybody. Don't take everything.
I think we've reached a point in America where we have to look on ourselves as more of a diverse nation.
That is the trailer for Manzanar Diverted. It will have its world broadcast premiere on PBS POV tonight at 7 p.m. Pacific time and will stream for free until August 18th at pbs.org and on the PBS video app. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Today we are joined by Anne Kaneko, director and producer of Manzanar Diverted. Anne is an Emmy Award-winning independent documentary filmmaker who is known for her personal films that weave her intimate aesthetic with the complex intricacies of political reality. Anne Kaneko currently teaches media studies at Pitzer College. Hi, Anne. Thank you so much for joining us again.
I am so excited to be here again. We love talking to you.
Well, it's great to have you back. Thank you so much. We're also joined by Jin Yu Kim, the film's producer. Jin Yu Kim is a Korean-Bolivian-American independent film producer who was a Sundance Creative Producers Fellow, a Firefight Media Impact Producing Fellow. Hi, Jin. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Hi, thank you so much. And it's Firelight Media. But thank you so much.
Great. Well, thank you so much. You know, we had you both on last May when the film premiered at CamFest, but we had you on for a short pre-taped conversation. And during that conversation, I said, we really want to have you back so listeners can interact with you. And I'm so glad to hear that you're having your world broadcast premiere on PBS tonight at 7 p.m. Pacific. So huge congrats to both of you. And Anne, since we had you on, You've been very busy, and your film has just won so many awards. What has the experience been like for you over the past year?
Wow, it's been a really amazing experience just meeting and talking with audiences across the country and, you know, different kinds of venues, you know, community screenings, festival screenings, also at universities. And it's really been very affirming to hear how I think people all across the country have really resonated with the film and the film's issues. So, you know, we hope that the film does the same with this broadcast as it goes out to a much, much larger audience. So we're excited. I just also wanted to mention that we realize that the broadcast probably, you know, people should really check their local listings because actually here in Southern California on KCT, it's at 10 p.m., not 7 p.m. I think we were, we might have had some of the wrong information. So we just want to encourage people up in the Bay Area to check your local listings because it might actually be at 10, not 7.
Okay, and we'll double check that. So be sure to check your local listings. Jen, I just read an article you wrote for Firelight Media, and you said that initially you did not expect this film to connect with audiences all over the country in such a profound way, but the themes that you touched on really did resonate with so many people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we always actually thought this was such a Californian story. And I think we knew when we were doing our early research that there were some global examples where things like this was happening. Like, for example, I was born in Bolivia. And in Bolivia, the second largest lake was completely drained to quench the thirst of the people around. And so I knew personally there was like kind of like the similar themes happening globally, but it was just kind of the back of my head. And so we were just chugging along making the documentary, but once we started doing the festival circuit, it was clear, like as the film continued traveling on to different regions, almost every region we went to, there was some similar story of, you know, resource extraction, communities coming together. So it was really, it was one of those things like where, you know, when you're making a film, people say like the more specific you are and the more you know your own story, it will touch people globally. So I think we really experienced that with this documentary.
Right. And we just checked the listings. It is going to broadcast in the Bay Area on PBS tonight at 10 p.m. Pacific time. But depending on where you are, be sure to check your local listings. Well, I'm glad we have now more time than we had last time to really dive into these issues. And we also can open the phone lines to hear from listeners, because last time we did a pre-taped interview with you. So let's just go back to the beginning and, you know, talk to us about what took you to Manzanar and why did you decide to dive in so deep looking at the history of Manzanar? And then it's really amazing to meet intergenerational women who form an alliance to defend their land and water from the powerful LA Department of Water and Power. So Anne, when did you first learn about this place?
Well, of course, Manzanar is something I've probably known about all my life. My parents were both incarcerated during World War II, my parents and grandparents, not at Manzanar, but certainly that legacy of incarceration during World War II is part of my family. So I think growing up, we took trips through the Eastern Sierras. And I remember stopping through Manzanar. And of course, it was important to my parents because that was the experience that they had had as young people. So that was all, you know, always loomed large. And I think especially in the Asian American community as well, you know, Manzanar has become a real symbol for the Asian American movement. So that its importance has always held a great amount of weight. I think in specifically in terms of this story, I remember reading about, you know, Los Angeles and its involvement in Manzanar, but I don't think I really comprehended what that meant. And I was actually invited by some colleagues to work on a project around Manzanar, a humanities project looking at sort of interfaith and interfaith and intercultural connections. And so in that context, I was like, oh my gosh, Manzanar is such a, you know, there's so much amazing work that's been done. What can I you know, do that's different, that's fresh, given that so many films have been made about it. And as I was doing research, I really realized, of course, this was Los Angeles Department of Water and Power lands. And that because it was public lands, that's why it became this camp. And then, of course, I learned about this horrible forced removal of Numu and Nua, the Paiute and the Shoshone, from this area to Fort Tejon, 200 miles away. And so these intersections of these forced removals really, and also the story of water and the story of ranchers being forced off of this land because it was purchased by the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. All of these stories converged, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is a really amazing opportunity to tell this much larger story of water, the West, of you know, colonization, and these histories of forced removal. And so then I began on this long path. I think that was in 2015 when I first attended my first attendance at the Manzanar pilgrimage, but it really launched me on this path of research and, you know, getting to know people in the community and learning much more about this history.
Your parents and grandparents were incarcerated during World War II?
Yes. I am a very, very young sansei, so it's very unusual. My mother, you know, she just passed away last year. She was 100.
Oh,
and
wow.
My grandparents were, you know, passed away earlier. But because of that, you know, I'm able to span all of these histories in a very, very direct way. I might also mention that, you know, my mom was very much a conservation minded person. And so growing up in Los Angeles, you know, Tongva lands, Los Angeles, I was always very aware of water as being so precious. She encouraged us to save water during the drought years, especially during the 70s, but really all through the time I was growing up, we would use gray water in the yard and flush our toilets, maybe more so than other folks, but you know, that really was ingrained in me. And so the importance of this story and our connection here in Southern California to this place so far, you know, not so far away, but yes, also far away, was really important. And so I realized that if I didn't understand this very important history and connection and how we are all tied to this land and water, then other people probably also didn't understand that. And so that's also what sort of launched me down this path.
It's amazing. And just given your family's history, this must have been such an incredible experience for you to meet other, you know, people whose parents were incarcerated or other people who were incarcerated, and then to meet, you know, Native people like Kathy Jefferson Bancroft with the Lone Pine Paiute Shoshone tribe. I mean, this, looking at the archival footage, and then, gosh, I just wonder what your initial reaction was when you were able to breathe and sit down and watch the completed film.
Oh my gosh. I mean, it's really been, every documentary project, I mean, and this is why I love documentary filmmaking so much. I mean, there's certainly its downsides, but you know, it's just a gift that keeps giving, because you meet and learn so much through the process, you know, and so many people have, you know, really opened their arms to share their stories with us. And so we're so pleased to be able to, you know, highlight these stories. I know for Kathy, we just had this day of action yesterday, really amazing, sort of tying together these threads of you know, Native American forced removal, Japanese American stories, as well as environmental stories across the country. We had folks from Buffalo area, as well as, you know, Seattle, Minidoka. So, you know, but Kathy was really, you know, she's somebody who's so amazing and strong. And she was talking about the recent nomination for Patsyata, Owens Lake, as a historic site. And she really got emotional. And I know from knowing her for these last few years that she's like a very strong person, and it takes a lot for her to kind of show that side to, of her. But I think it's just really been so meaningful to be able to give that space to so many people.
Jen, what about you? When did you first learn about Manzanar and the history of this, of that area?
Manzanar, I learned a little bit about during college when I took an Asian American studies course. But before that, of course, it's not in our, you know, history books growing up. I also split my time between the U.S. and Bolivia. So I think maybe I had a gap in those years where I maybe would have learned about it. I'm not sure. But when I was Anne Kaneko's mentee, because she was my mentor during this program called Armed with a Camera under Visual Communications. And I think we connected because she had like a Peru connection, I had a Bolivia connection. But it wasn't until like 2017 when she came to me and asked me to produce this film. And at first I didn't really, even though I knew about Manzanar, I didn't really know much more about it, right? And so when she came and asked me to produce it, I read the treatment, and I was really just completely shocked. And I was like, if I, as a Korean person, and who lives in Los Angeles, if I don't know anything about this, probably not many people living in Los Angeles, they don't either. And then the fact that the intersectional aspect of like this land where, you know, Japanese Americans were incarcerated during World War II is also the land where we get our water from. And it's also the land where Native Americans were forcibly removed from. I bet no one knows about this. And that's what my draw was we need to educate Angelenos about this piece of history that was, seemed like it was purposefully kept from us. And there are bigger forces to make sure that we don't know each other's histories. And what would it look like if we did? And how could we build coalition with communities if we knew what happened to other communities? And how can we build a stronger force against this foe? And so for me, when I came to the story, it was really the impact potential of the film that I was really drawn to. And you know, like even yesterday when we had a day of action, we kept learning more things, more connections between Indigenous and Japanese American connections in different camps, different areas. So it's almost like a never ending journey of discovery. And I think that's what I love most about this doc, is there is no limit to how much education we could get from this.
And based on the conversations you've had with people who've seen the film, would you say that the overwhelming majority of people in Los Angeles did not know this history?
Yes, exactly. And some people might know some pieces of it. Like, I think there's a good entry point for people. If you're a Japanese American, you know the Japanese American side. If you're Native American, you know the Native American side. If you're a conservationist, you might know like where we get our water from. But those entry points are great because these people will come and watch the film and then they're like, oh, you know, I didn't know this other aspect of this other community that intersects with my own history. So even the experts would gain something from it. And so I don't know, Anne, like, I don't think we've ever had someone say like, oh, I knew everything about this documentary. I learned nothing. What do you think, Anne?
I know, it's really been overwhelming because people who are experts in their field around, you know, who are from the Valley or people who work with water and work directly with the, you know, Department of Water and Power, researchers, you know, people who you would think would really know this history. But so many people was like, oh my goodness, thank you so much. I've learned so much from this film. I didn't know, you know, about these specific aspects. So that's very gratifying. And especially because in a film, you can only sort of scratch the surface of so many things. You know, it's not like a book that really can be more comprehensive and exhaustive. But I think that because the film is able to pull together all of these different threads, it has really been eye-opening for a lot of people.
Well, you can see the film Manzanar Diverted. It'll have its world broadcast premiere on PBS tonight. Check your local listings for times. In many places, it is at 10 p.m. Pacific, or 10 p.m., I should say, no matter where you are. But be sure to check your local listings. It'll also stream for free until August 18th at pbs.org and on the PBS video app. And when does the streaming start?
I believe that also starts right after the broadcast. So people should, you know, get on it. Okay. That month will pass quickly.
Okay. And you can find more information and also watch the trailer at yourcallradio.org. Anne Kaneko is director and producer of Manzanar Diverted, and Jin Yu Kim is the film's producer. And if you have any questions for them, if you are familiar with Owens Valley, what is now called Owens Valley, and Manzanar, but you'd like to know more about the history, we're going to get into all of that. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. So let's talk first about the first peoples of this area. Again, Kathy Jefferson Bancroft with the Lone Pine Paiute Shoshone tribe says that the story of the valley starts when white settlers moved in, and the history of her people who lived here before anyone came is either whitewashed or just pushed away or ignored. So the indigenous people called the Owens Valley Paya Hanadu, or
Paya Hunadu.
Thank you. Hunadu, or the land of flowing water, and settled along the banks of its river, creeks, and springs for more than 150 years ago. So, Anne, first off, tell us a little bit about the indigenous people who were in this area first.
So I believe that they have, you know, it's, you know, thousands. It's really millennia that these people have been living there. And, you know, it was a place of much abundance in terms of water. And so they used their natural irrigation systems to grow food for themselves. And all of that was disrupted when settler colonialists came into the valley and started grazing cattle there. And really, as is the case across the country, I think that the conflicts with indigenous people has really been about food. You know, when your food sources are impacted, then what do you do? And so I feel like so many of those conflicts, you know, they call it the Owens Valley Indian Wars. I was careful not to name it that, because in my mind, they were not wars, which would imply maybe some sort of more parody, but it really was kind of like a massacre or a genocide, I feel like. Mm-hmm. But, you know, these conflicts began because their food sources were being threatened. And, you know, they were tricked. I mean, it's a horrible story, the story of this forced removal. But folks, you know, who were in conflict with the U.S. Army and the colonialists at that time were sort of tricked to come to Camp Independence right on the 4th of July, you know, to celebrate. They said, we can, you know, talk things through, we can feed you. And so many people came, you know, with this spirit of trying to work things out. And then they were held hostage there. And starting on July 11th, they were forced to march 200 miles to Fort Tejon, which is, you know, was the San Sebastian Reservation, lands of another people. And along that, I think it was about 1,000 people. And along that, you know, 200-mile trek in the middle of a very hot summer. I mean, if you know the climate in that area, July, it, you know, we were just there, you know, participating in a forced, you know, in a commemorative run. And by the time we ended at 10, 11 o'clock, it was 106 degrees. So, you know, in 2 weeks' time, they forced people to walk across this land to this other place. Many people escaped, many people died. So it's a very dark history. But I think that, you know, Kathy and so many people, you know, that I know from there, they're always very careful to emphasize that it's a story of resilience, because despite all of that, people have survived. And they continue to live and are a huge presence, a huge part of the community in Paya Hunadu now.
You know, this history is so important. And again, thank you both for telling it, because I feel like as some segments of our society actually want to dive deep and learn about the true history of this country, still the Native story is not really a focus, or it's just kind of an afterthought. And so just to dive a little deeper, when you talk about the outsiders bringing in herds of cattle, trampling the food supplies, when Native people were hungry, they would kill a cow because they needed food, and then they would be killed for killing a cow. And as you said, Anne, this happened in so many communities across this country. I mean, the history of California especially is just so brutal.
Yes. I mean, because of this, you know, through this film, I've met, you know, other communities and other places. I was really moved. I just had a screening in the Twin Cities and, you know, a guy, you know, it's the same story there, the Dakota. And then, you know, also someone who was working there who was Lakota. I mean, you know, you read these histories and it is, it's always about food and protecting your homeland. This is your, this is where you live. And I feel like, you know, really none of us, I mean, I think that we have this notion, oh, there was this particular trail of tears, but really that story happened everywhere across this country. And the story of, you know, forced removal of, you know, of resistance to that is really the story that happened across this country.
Right. And before we go to break, Jen, just one more fact. Between 1862 and 1863, the military and settlers massacred hundreds of indigenous people in this area. Many were gunned down at Owens Lake. There were seven different massacres that took place on the lake. What was your reaction when you learned about this history?
I mean, I feel like every information I learned during the making of this documentary was just so eye-opening, right? And as Anne mentioned, like, this is, you know, it wasn't like an equal war. It was a genocide. And I also think back to when we were framing this documentary as this is the story of the West, right? And the story of the West that people may not have a deeper connection to now, you know, with all the Westerns that were like exposed to. But one of the things that really drew me in, and you could see this in the documentary as well, was just how indigenous people who live on the land, land is not just land. It is like a relative. It is part of the life force and the life source. And so when massacres are happening in the lake, when your ancestors' bones are buried there and the lake is a living and breathing thing, it's almost like seeing someone destroy your family member. And so we really connected to that in an emotional sense, because it is also a paradigm shift for us as filmmakers, because, you know, we are outsiders, right? And we're coming in, and we're coming in with the knowledge that we have from our various backgrounds. But when you learn how people see the land and their relationship to the land and how that could really inform our future and how we conserve and how we protect our land, that was my biggest takeaway from those facts.
Well, again, you can see the film Manzanar Diverted tonight. It has its world broadcast premiere on PBS, and then will stream for free until August 18th at pbs.org and on the PBS video app. You can check your local listings for times and head over to yourcallradio.org for more information. Jin Yu Kim is producer of Manzanar Diverted, When Water Becomes Dust, and Ann Kaneko is director and producer of Manzanar Diverted. We're going to take a quick break. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will discuss the rollout of the 988 Suicide and Crisis Hotline, which is now live. Anyone experiencing a mental health crisis can call or text 988 to seek support from a trained mental health professional. The goal is to connect people immediately and reduce confrontations with law enforcement. The new line will also provide specialized services for LGBTQ youth. Tomorrow, we will learn more about this line. find out, well, really talk about how can we ensure that it is funded and that there are enough professionals out there to take these phone calls. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. If you'd like to join today's conversation about the documentary Manzanar Diverted, When Water Becomes Dust, we'd love to hear from you. If you have lived or live in Los Angeles, are you familiar with this history? What questions do you have for our guests? Jin Yu Kim is the film's producer. Ann Kaneko is director and producer of Manzanar Diverted. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Manzanar Diverted will have its world broadcast premiere on PBS tonight. Check your local listings for times. The film will then stream for free until August 18th at pbs.org. and on the PBS video app. So let's talk a little bit about what happened with the powerful Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, which took over the land and its rich water resources in early 1900. And can you just first tell us about how powerful this department is?
You know, I feel like, well, we all know, well, maybe we all don't know, but, you know, I think this, the story that, you know, is in the film Chinatown really says a lot about Los Angeles's relationship to this place and what water means to Los Angeles. Los Angeles wouldn't exist if it didn't have water. And so therefore, this entity, the LADWP, is very powerful. It really, you know, although it's a public entity, it is, you know, supported by its sale of water. And so it is very powerful and kind of runs in this kind of public-private sort of way. But it basically, you know, through Mulholland, I'm sure you're familiar with the names William Mulholland, Thomas Eaton. Those were sort of the players in our that California Water Wars story. And ranchers, you know, in the 1920s rose up and took over the Alabama Gates, you know, also were resistant to this kind of takeover. They actually dynamited the Alabama Gates. And because basically what their livelihood was highly impacted because of the diversion of this water. And so the waters that flowed into Patsiata, which is a terminal lake, Owens Lake, basically made this immense lake go dry in just 10 years. Mm-hmm. It was, the third largest lake in California. And now it's this dry area that you can pass by on the 395 as you either head north from the Southern California area, or if you're heading south from sort of the Mammoth area. It's this very large area that's sort of white and chalky. And then you also see the DWP's infrastructure that they've built to sort of help mitigate the dust, which was the problem that ensued after the lake became dry. It became this major source of dust. In fact, it was the worst source of dust in the country, and many people in the valley and in the areas have, you know, suffer from respiratory problems because of the dust from that valley. In fact, in the film, you know, Kathy and Sue Embry both, you know, talk about these health issues that they have. So, you know, the DWP has had to mitigate the dust problem, and you know, and then now they're also, because of the long-term water agreement, they've also had to kind of, you know, the amount of water that they're pumping from the valley has been, like, you know, there are certain limits on how much water they can pump out of the valley, especially after they constructed the second aqueduct. They had to, you know, put some limits because it was really making the valley dry. So, you know, and then with the different tribes in the area, you know, I shouldn't say none of them, but most of them don't have water rights. it's a bitter irony that they live in this place of much abundance in terms of water, but you know, when the federal government you know, had this land exchange with the Los Angeles Department of Water Power, it did not come with water rights. And that had to be sort of negotiated. And to this day, that still remains an issue.
Hmm. But, and this happened in 1939 when they lost their water rights.
Yes. Yes. Right. I believe.
Right. We have a couple of questions from listeners who just want to thank you both for making this film. And these listeners say they didn't know much about this history, and they're wondering what you want people to walk away with after viewing this film. Jen, do you want to take that one?
Yes, sure. So we have a couple goals with our impact campaign, but our major goal above anything is to educate Southern Californians and people who live in any metropolitan city that gets their water from somewhere else. Because really the education is the first step before we can really build coalitions to figure out like what we can do in terms of changing laws, conservation efforts. But the first step is education, because most people don't know this history. And so like, for example, what we did yesterday with the Day of Action was we brought together groups, organizations, over 10 organizations from Native American, Japanese American, and conservation groups together to have a conversation about all of the overlaps and the intersections and how we could build together. So that's our major goal, is watch the film. There's a lot more resources we have on our website at www.manzanardiverted.com. We're going to be continuing to add resources to our website, including an interactive map that will show the intersections of Native American reservations with Japanese American carceral spaces. And also, you know, resource extractions that are happening in those areas as well. We have an educational curriculum. We have a discussion guide. So all of these things will be on our website, including film clips from. We have so many amazing bonus clips that didn't make the film, you know, and went there and shot so much stuff that, you know, when we're forming the documentary, we had to piece together a coherent story. So there's a lot of things that are so valuable and so information heavy that couldn't make the film. So those will also be available on our website.
And what would you add?
I think, you know, sort of simply, it's like, we really want people to understand the responsibility that they have to their water, to the land and water that we take for granted, right? That, you know, understand where your water comes. It's a thing that we, you know, water is something that we really take for granted. And yet it is becoming, you know, and as, you know, in the face of climate change, it's a very important and valuable resource. And it's something that we need to really address, because there will be water shortages, especially as our population grows. Right. So, you know, I think it's really just to have a better and deeper understanding, and to take action, take responsibility.
Mm. Let's talk about the Japanese Americans who were incarcerated at the Owens Valley Manzanar camp from 1942 to 1945. Why did the federal government choose this area for this camp? Anne?
So in terms of all of the concentration camps, you know, one of the sort of prerequisites is that they had the availability of water, because the federal government really wanted to make sure that the incarcerees could grow their own food. They wanted the prisoners to grow their own food and provide for themselves, essentially. And then of course these sites had to be away from the West Coast, which is where they were moving Japanese Americans from, because they perceived that they were this threat of Sabbath, you know, threat basically. So, you know, it's so interesting how Manzanar was established in Paihunadu. And basically I think you know, when they decided that they were going to, you know, remove all of these people from the West Coast, they were searching around for different places. And then they came upon this huge parcel of land with that had abundant, had an abundance of water. And so initially they wanted the War Relocation Authority wanted to lease much of Los Angeles Department of Water and Power's lands to incarcerate, I think it was maybe 60,000, you know, over 100,000 Japanese Americans were incarcerated from the West Coast. So it was like more than half, I know, of all of the people here in that valley. And so, but, you know, LADWP pushed back and said, oh, no, absolutely not. We don't, you know, this is the water for the city of Los Angeles, which ironically is the place where so many of these citizens were being, you know, were being forced from. But so they said, no, we don't want you to build this camp here. They're going to sabotage our water supply. And so that's no good. So, but then of course the WR, and so that actually they told them to go to this other place that in the Colorado River, you know, where Poston exists now. And they said, oh, we know this other great place. It's basically Native American land, you know? And so I think it's so interesting because you get a real sense of how these public entities all played a role in this state sponsored racist act. Right. And so DWP then so then the WRA came back to Los Angeles Department of Water and Power and said, oh yeah, that's a great place. We're going to build a camp over there. And then we would also like to build a camp here. And so they scaled it down and then they said, we'll take Manzanar, which was a former orchard community. And because of the diversions of water, was no longer a viable place to grow, you know, apples and pears anymore. And so then they said, and then the infrastructure for water already existed because of this orchard community. And so they settled on creating a Manzanar at that place. And, but, you know, it's so interesting because, you know, after the war ended, the DWP was like, okay, no more, you can't lease our land anymore. And you must return the land exactly as it was. Because I think that they thought, well, we've got all these barracks here. It could potentially be a place where, you know, vets could go, you know, they need housing, all these possibilities since this community, this town, which was probably larger than most of the other communities in the area, could potentially use. But they said, no, you need to return it to the way it is, the way it was, because this is our water source.
In the film, we also meet Sue Kunatami Embry, who was born in 1923 in Los Angeles. She grew up in Little Tokyo prior to World War II. And on May 9th, 1942, along with her widowed mother and six brothers and sisters, she was sent to the Manzanar concentration camp. She was only 19 years old, and she was held there for 17 months. Sue became such an amazing activist. Jin, can you tell us a little bit more about Sue? She became editor of the camp's newspaper, the Manzanar Free Press. What a name, the Manzanar Free Press. Jin?
Oh, and then we'll actually let Anne.
Oh, hello. Anne?
Hello?
Oh, yes. Sorry. Do you want me to answer that question?
Yeah, I think I'm losing my audio.
Oh, okay. All right.
We'll check your audio. Okay, go ahead, Anne.
So Sue, you know, I think most folks in the Japanese American community know of her because she did such amazing work. She was really important to getting both state and then federal recognition of Manzanar as a national historic site. And she was a very uncompromising woman. She was a radical progressive, you know, really working towards making change for many communities in the LA area, not just Japanese Americans, just really ahead of her time. And then, you know, this recognition of Manzanar as a historic site really became her life's work. And she, you know, took this on, you know, making sure that at a time when so many people of her generation were still unwilling or, you know, were still traumatized by the experience. But she was not afraid to speak publicly about it. And so she became this amazing activist. And I think that we should also acknowledge that very, very much during all of these conversations and discussions about establishing it as a historic site, she wanted to make sure that Native Americans were acknowledged in this, because she knew the history. She knew that Native Americans were also forced from that place and that that was their land. You know, this was much, much before, you know, I know now we have these land acknowledgments and way before that ever became in vogue, she understood this history and understood the importance of these people on this land. And so she made sure that they were involved in these conversations. And she, you know, wanted to make sure that at the historic site that their history would also be acknowledged. And so she became this, you know, she was the co-chair, co-founder of the Manzanar Committee. When she passed, her son, Bruce Embry, who appears in the film, took that over. He's an activist in his own right. And then her granddaughter, you know, Bruce's daughter, really has carried on that mantle and, you know, has become an activist like her grandmother. She came to study in Southern California because she wanted to be close to Sue before she passed. And she now is an activist with Sierra Club and works on energy.
It was also so interesting to hear Sue, you know, talk about this period being the most traumatic experience of her life. She said that her mom would sit under the apple trees and cry. And Sue studied American history. She went to public school in Los Angeles and said, I really thought I was American, but I gave up the idealistic idea of democracy to a realistic one. I mean, that just says so much.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Jen, are you back on? Do you want to say something?
Sure. I think, you know, it resonates even today, right? I think what she was really implying there was that racism existed then and it continues to exist today. And as much as we are born here, as much as we feel we're American, there's always going to be the perpetual foreigner stereotype when it comes to Asian American communities, no matter how long we've been here, and we've been here for a really long time. So I think that's what she's speaking to. But I also wanted to add, just in terms of Sue's character in the documentary, her character is portrayed through archival footage because she passed away a while ago, and her legacy is carried on by Monica and Bruce. But one of the cool things about the documentary was when you're watching it, the archival footage, she comes so alive. Like, even though, like, she's no longer here with us, like, her work and her presence on the land, it really connects the past and the present together. It's almost like, you know, we were joking, but, you know, it kind of does make sense, but that it kind of feels like you're being teleported through time. And a lot of that is with the presence of Sue. Every time she comes on screen, you really feel like you're back in time with her, or she's here with you.
You know, we're almost out of time, and I'm sorry to ask you this question with only 1 minute to go, but, you know, at a time when there are so many forces to ensure that this type of history is not taught in schools, that we don't focus on what you all focus on the film. Jen, what are your thoughts on that? What can we do to make sure the kind of information that you all present in the film is seen by the widest audience possible? And what can we do to fight these forces that are trying to ensure that this kind of history is not told?
Well, one of the reasons we decided to broadcast with POV on PBS was because they have the most reach in terms of the American audience. So we are really excited about this broadcast coming up tonight at 10 p.m. And that it will be available for anyone to watch for a whole month. And we want to be as involved in terms of community. You know, we have already built our curriculum, but we want to get into as many schools as possible, high schools, universities. So we did our part. So we hope the schools will also, you know, absorb this information and teach it to the students.
Yes, I was going to ask you if high school and college students will be seeing this film. And we have about a minute left. What would you add?
I will say that I think that you know, it's really behooves us all to learn this history. The film, you know, highlights this coming together, a building of a coalition between these unlikely partners. And I think in the face of all of the divisiveness that we face right now, that is a lesson that we can learn from. And it's also a lesson that we can, you know, we need to tell the stories, and we need to have the access to the stories that we want to hear and learn. So I think that, you know, that's a lesson for those who are fighting for fighting against climate change, for environmental activists, but it's also a lesson for social, you know, social justice activists to make these stories heard and known.
And we should say that this doesn't end with what happened in the past. There are many, many people working right now to defend their land and water from the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. So we really hope you can see this film, Manzanar Diverted. It'll have its world broadcast premiere on PBS tonight at 10 p.m. Check your local listings for times. And then it will stream for free until August 18th at pbs.org and the PBS video app. Anne Kaneko is director and producer of Manzanar Diverted, and Jin Yu Kim is producer of Manzanar Diverted. Anne and Jin, thank you again. I'm so glad that we were able to have you back for the full hour. Thank you for making this incredible documentary. It was great to have you back.
Thank you so much, Rose.
Yes, thank you so much, Rose. It was such a great conversation.
Thank you. And you can find more information about the film and how to watch it at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. And we hope you can join us tomorrow. We will discuss the rollout of the 988 Suicide and Crisis Hotline, which is now live. You can listen to our past shows and sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. We're at yourcallradio. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.